This is Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. We originate on Co-op, which is an all-volunteer community radio station, solar-powered and cooperatively run by the volunteers here at the station. So I don't know of any other stations like this in the country. There may be. But it's very cool. We are also rebroadcast on several other community radio stations around the country. Our podcast appears at Veterans Today website and at the Rag Blog. And I think our show, I used this term earlier, our show has legs. It gets out there. So we want to thank you for being with us today. Tracy Schultz is my engineer, and he's kind of smirking over there.
No.
That wasn't a smirk?
Yeah.
It was smirk-like.
It's good times.
Okay. And Roger Baker's taking pictures. My guest is, and I always have, you know, the title, the, you know, government professor and Middle East expert, Roy Casagrande. We're talking about Citizen Trump Takes on the World. I had to come up with something, and I thought that was kind of cool.
I like it.
That's good, because you're the one who's going to have to talk about it. Government professor and Middle East expert Roy Casagrande will discuss Donald Trump's first 90 days in general and his foreign policy in particular, especially as it relates to Syria, Afghanistan, and North Korea. Casagrande was our guest before on Rag Radio twice, and we discussed, this was in December of 2015, and we discussed ISIL. The first show was ISIL and the origins of the Syrian crisis, and the second one was how U.S. actions in Iraq set the table for ISIL. But it was all kind of intertwined, and I have to say that Roy has always impressed me with his knowledge, and I mean, I've seen some of his videos. Roy teaches at Austin Community College, and I've seen some of his video lectures on Syria and other things that are just incredibly good in the way that you can tell things in sort of simple, understandable ways, but very and communicate very complex things. So anyway, Roy Casagrande is an associate professor of government at Austin Community College, where he teaches U.S. and Texas politics. His areas of research include Middle East history and politics, U.S. foreign policy, political philosophy, and warfare. And as if that isn't sort of a wide enough range, he is, and I guess you're still in the process of working on the PhD?
Yes.
Okay. That can be an extended process, I know. He is currently completing an ad hoc interdisciplinary PhD to further his reputation as a Renaissance man. At the University of Texas at Austin. He also serves as an analyst on Middle East political affairs. Do you still do this for KVUE? For the ABC affiliate in Austin, KVUE, and has written about Arab and U.S. politics and history for several publications in Iran. Now, what else is new? Is there anything that isn't included in there? What else are you up to?
That's really it.
That's enough of it?
Yeah.
So, okay. What we're going to do is you gave me a clip and that is kind of an interesting way to start off the show. So I'm going to ask Tracy to play that right now.
It's great to be with the president of Egypt. And I will tell you, President El-Sisi has been somebody that's been very close to me from the first time I met him. I met during the campaign.
Yes.
And at that point, there were two of us, and we both met. And hopefully you liked me a lot more. But
yes.
but it was a very long, it was supposed to be just a quick, brief meeting, and we were with each other for a long period of time. We agree on so many things. I just want to let everybody know, in case there was any doubt, that we are very much behind President El-Sisi. He's done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. We are very much behind Egypt and the people of Egypt, and the United States has, believe me, backing, and we have strong backing. We are very much, and as you and I will be soon talking, we are building up our military to a level that will be the highest, probably the highest that we've ever had, plane orders, ship orders, aircraft carrier orders. We are rejuvenating our military to the highest level. I think in these times, probably more than ever before, or certainly almost more than ever before, that's what we need. And I just want to say to you, Mr. President, that you have a great friend and ally in the United States and in me.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and we should point out that that was not Roy Casagrande speaking. But I think you do have a certain affinity with things Egyptian.
I do.
Would that be
yes.
true?
Yeah.
Why might that be?
I'm part Egyptian.
The rest is sort of
Swedish, Finnish, German, Italian.
That's what I thought. All purpose. Okay. That take off from that clip.
Okay, so the clip is really about a relatively minor thing. It's, you know, the president of the United States meeting the president of Egypt. On the surface, you wouldn't think much of it, except what gets said is remarkable. I think it gives us a little bit of a window into President Trump. He starts off by saying, I was really close to this guy from the moment I met him. What does that mean? Are they sending each other emails regularly? Have they become Facebook friends? You know, are they following each other on Twitter? And then he goes on to say, there were two of us and we both met. What does that mean? Is this a metaphysical thing? Could there have been more than two of them? Might they have not met? He goes, in case anybody was wondering, I needed to be clear that the United States and Egypt are allies. Basically, something to that effect. Nobody was wondering this. We give them $1.45 billion a year in bribe money. This is clear. Sisi's in a difficult time. What does that mean? Well, what it means is Sisi's having a hard time putting down the Egyptian population, which wants democracy, and he's trying to prevent them from having that. You know, this is a very strange window into Trump.
Okay, and Trump's very strange, and getting a window into him in any area is very difficult. And there are those who say that what he believes is what he heard from the last person he talked to.
And there's some reason to believe that. I mean, that's what Eric Trump seems to think.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So that means he's flexible. He can learn.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then forget it. And then during the election, so one of the raps on him was that he had no focus, no concentration, no continuity in his thinking. It certainly seems to. Much of what we saw in the campaign seems to have been the real Donald Trump.
I mean, I think we're seeing that with the foreign policy. Yeah. He said one thing during the campaign, and now he's doing different things. But then he's also changed since being president.
Yeah. In what ways?
Well, so the interesting thing about
he's certainly changed a lot of policy positions that he campaigned on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Think about the Syria situation. He tweeted in 2013 when Obama was, had said that the Bashar al-Assad government had crossed a red line and that we were sort of preparing ourselves mentally for a war. He tweeted that we shouldn't go to war with Syria, that we should spend that money here at home. During the campaign, he repeatedly said he didn't want to do a war with Syria. He wanted to work with the Syrian government and the Russians in the fight against ISIL. When he became president, he reiterated that. The week before we sent the 59 Tomahawk missiles into that Syrian Air Force base, he had even said that we were taking removing Bashar al-Assad from government off the table, that we were no longer going to pursue that policy. And then all of a sudden, we're attacking the airbase. And according to Eric Trump, his son, Ivanka, was in tears begging her dad to do it, and that was what motivated her father to do it. And, that's a fast turnaround.
Well, that certainly feeds the narrative that, before we started, that he was a dangerous person to have to have the nuclear code, because he seems to respond to whatever is, and especially to certain people and to certain ideas. I love it. I had a thing. I saw a thing in foreign policy, and they said that that the new team has escalated America's involvement in conflicts around the world, in several cases putting brave men and women in uniform in harm's way with no public debate and with little public notice. For example, Trump has gone to great lengths to tout his decision to fire 59 cruise missiles into Syria, but his administration has not addressed what is in many ways a more consequential decision, the deployment of hundreds more U.S. service members, including for the first time conventional forces into Syria to fight the Islamic State. And the bombings of the airstrip, the airport, whatever you want to call it, suddenly, I mean, a lot of people suddenly say, oh, well, now he's presidential.
Right.
You know, even liberal commentators and stuff, you know, somehow maybe that's what you have to do, is that you have to drop bombs to be a real president of the United States.
I mean, I think the politics of distraction is sort of an old story. In 1812, James Madison declares war on Great Britain cynically a month before the election to ensure that he gets reelected. And, you know, I think there's this tradition now in American politics. So my poll ratings are dropping. It's time to bomb somebody. It's time to distract the population. In August of 1998, Bill Clinton attacked Afghanistan and the Sudan, as the Monica Lewinsky scandal is sort of reaching a point where it was clear it was going to be a crisis. And then in December, he bombed Iraq again when, you know, in the build-up to the impeachment trial. So I think, and then, of course, George Bush Jr. in 2001 began antagonistically flying spy planes into Chinese airspace, or disputed Chinese airspace. And the Chinese responded with force, and we had that collision, that mid-air collision, where we had to The Chinese MiG and the pilot were killed, but the U.S. plane had to land in China, which is, of course, also embarrassing. And so, you know, I think Trump is sort of filling in that gap. He's in trouble with the Russian scandal and the possibility that there was this inappropriate connection. And the next thing you know, we're bombing Syria. Even before that, he had sent in the SEALs to Yemen and did that raid that doesn't appear to have had any real military value. And then he drops the Moab on Afghanistan.
Which makes no sense.
Yeah. And then, of course, just to make things more interesting, he's sending a fleet to Korea, although it turns out that it was going the wrong direction. And then, maybe it was going the right direction, and we really don't know where that fleet is at all. But in the meantime, the Chinese have responded by mobilizing 150,000 soldiers and sending them to the border with North Korea, and have asked the Russians for direct assistance in the event that the conflict escalates, and the Russians have agreed, and they're sending ships also to go intercept the fleet going the wrong way.
Regarding that, the wrong way fleet, that a friend of mine sort of paraphrased Sam Cooke and said that Trump don't know no geography. So that's just a little incidental thing. You have a lot of background, and you've done an awful lot of study of the Middle East. Do you see any coherence to what he's doing?
I mean...
Not just the Middle East, but actually the East as well.
I think in the case of the Middle East, there's sort of an interesting situation. So right when we fire the missiles, he gets up in front of the world and he says, refugees pose a threat to the United States and Europe, which is insane. I mean, it doesn't make sense. People fleeing their homes don't pose a threat to anybody. The fact that he keeps harping on this, as if I want to solve the problem to prevent these Arabs from coming to our homes and asking us for help. If you wanted to end the conflict, you wouldn't fire 59 missiles into an airbase. You would probably actually have one choice, and that would be to support Bashar al-Assad's regime. The guys that were Jabhat al-Nusra, they've changed their name, Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, those guys were al-Qaeda affiliates. We can't work with them. ISIL, obviously, we want to blow them up, so we can't work with them.
And they want to blow each other up, but then that's another story.
Right, and it turns out ISIL had chemical weapons in Mosul, and for all we know, they were the ones who used the chemical weapons on Idlib because there was no investigation. And it was Jabhat Fatah al-Sham that was gassed in Idlib. It was so potentially our enemies. And then there's the Free Syrian Army, which is in ruins, and they're a suspect anyway. The Kurds don't want to conquer all of Syria. They just want to conquer a big chunk of it for themselves and then break it off. But then if they do, then Turkey goes to war with them, and so they're not a good ally. And so, you know, there's nobody to work with except for the regime, which is the most powerful entity. And so even though I personally find the regime distasteful, if you were going to try to end the civil war, that would be the probably the only way to do it would be to support the regime. So attacking the regime has the effect of prolonging
it. And end up with just a strong man instead of a civil war, but, you know.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's going to be human rights violations.
One way or the other.
One way or the other. And you know, this person is not a nice guy. When the civil war first broke out, I was celebrating his imminent toppling, and it didn't happen. And right. And now I find myself eating crow and you know, wondering how this ends, if it ever does. In reality, though, our foreign policy position would be strengthened by the civil war never ending. We, you know, as one imperialist state against another, Syria is a Russian ally, and we don't want Russia to advance itself. So having Syria tied up in a civil war effectively eliminates Syria as a Russian ally. And of course, Syria is also an Iranian ally. And so that also eliminates an Iranian ally in the process. And it ties up Iranian and Russian resources in trying to bolster this regime. So, and then, of course, because our ally is Israel, and Israel is automatically against Syria, that it just helps us to have this civil war.
Yeah, and we should also point out that this country is pretty much invested in the concept of sort of endless war. You know, for a number of reasons. So, you know, look at Afghanistan, but that whole concept, I mean, partly because of what we used to refer to as the military-industrial complex, but it all feeds our economic system in such a way that dependency has been created. And of course, now Trump wants to. What does he want to balloon? I mean, we have the. I think we have a larger military. We have than the next 10. Countries after us or something. I mean, there's some incredible thing, and yet it's inadequate.
Right. Know. Yeah, and that's the other thing that's in that clip is he says we're going to be building up the size of our military. You know, our military budget's maybe 35% of the Earth's entire military budget. It might even be higher, but at that point, what's the point in having a larger military? I mean, are we worried the whole world's going to gang up on us? In that case, we clearly need to make it bigger. But if if our goal is to be a deterrent, then we don't need a military this size, especially because the nukes presumably are a deterrent. What's the point in spending all this money on nukes if they don't actually deter anything? And also, if we're doing a war against terrorism, which is, you know, presumably what we're doing, we don't need tanks and aircraft carriers. Mm-hmm. What we need people on the ground, and people on the ground with an assault rifle. And the irony, of course, is we don't even do that anymore because Obama, it started under Bush, but Obama is the one who sort of pushed this to the forefront, began using drones. And drones are great because nobody on our side dies, but they sort of indiscriminately kill on the other side, and they don't secure anything in the process. And so drones just create more chaos. They don't actually solve anything. But it allows American politicians to claim they're doing something without actually achieving anything, and then without risking people being killed on our side. And that helps them in terms of PR because they're so scared of somebody dying on our side.
Okay, we need to take a break. But when we come back, maybe we'll ask if there's any way to resolve all of this.
All right.
You know, I mean, I think we know the answer, but we talked about that a little bit the last time we were on. My guest is Roy Casagrande, and we're talking about, well, to kind of sum it up, Citizen Trump and the world. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.
Last night I had a lovely dream. I saw a big parade with ticker tape galore. And men were marching there the like I'd never seen before. Oh, the bankers and the diplomats are going in the army. Oh, happy day, I give my pay to see them on parade. Their paunches at attention and their striped pants at ease. They've gotten patriotic and they're going overseas. We'll have to do the best we can and bravely carry on. So we'll just keep the laddies here to manage while they're gone.
All together.
Oh, we hate to see them go.
The gentlemen of distinction in the army.
The bankers and the diplomats are going in the army. It seemed a shame to keep them from the wars they loved to plan. We're all of us contented that they'll fight a dandy war. They don't need propaganda, they know what they're fighting for. They'll march away with dignity and in the best of form. And we'll just keep the laddies here to keep the lassies warm.
Everybody sing!
Oh, oh, we hate to see them go. The gentlemen of distinction in the army.
The bankers and the diplomats are going in the army. We're going to make things easy because it's all so new and strange. We'll give them silver shovels when they have to dig a hole. And they can sing in harmony when answering the roll.
Okay, Malvina Reynolds. The wonderful Malvina Reynolds. The gentlemen of distinction are going into the army.
Tracy. Yeah. We hate to see them go. It's a good song.
Yeah, it's a wonderful song. and you know, good riddance, I guess. my guest, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Drag Radio. My guest is Roy Casagrande, government professor, Middle East expert, man about town. And it's so good to have you here again.
Thanks
and
for
we
having
were talking
me.
About oh it's an honor. We were talking about the almost impossible puzzle of the Middle East and Syria specifically. Are there any answers, do you think?
I mean, there are answers, and one of the answers is that the United States needs to actually be less engaged. We blew up Iraq. Blowing up Iraq caused al-Qaeda in Iraq to form, and then they fled and they went to Syria and they formed ISIL. I mean, this is our monster. We're Dr. Frankenstein. ISIL contributed to Syria's destabilization. Had ISIL not been where it was, and the Free Syrian Army had captured the territory that ISIL had captured, the civil war might be over by now with the Free Syrian Army in a state of victory. It's you know, these are what ifs, but they're what ifs that are because we intervened. Had we not intervened, we wouldn't have to have this conversation. That's one thing. We also tend to side with tyrants, right? We were supporting Hosni Mubarak. Now we support Sisi in Egypt. We're pretty good at sort of being on the wrong side of things. We side with the Saudis.
It's been a long and grand tradition,
right? And then we do really weird things, like when Obama blew up Libya. I mean, what was the point in that? We didn't have any plan to replace Muammar Gaddafi, and the next thing you know, Libya's gone. I mean, as a state, it's a failed state. It doesn't exist. It's a serious problem for terrorism. I think there's 10 major groups that own territory. The legitimate government of Libya owns the 10th largest city in Libya. You know, like it's a catastrophe, and it's a catastrophe that we sort of created. So you know, there's this thing. Why are we the policemen? We're not really the policemen. We're more like the kid that runs up and down the streets throwing rocks through the windows and breaking things.
Yeah, Molotov cocktails into the whatever. Yeah. Yes, that's a wonderful point. I love that. And you know, I mean, it's not we are not limited to the Middle East. We've done it in South America. We've done
for
it
for sure. Yeah,
all
Asia.
Over.
I mean, I was actually thinking of Eisenhower this morning, and just you know, sort of, he's one of those presidents who actually was less interventionist than most or than many in any case. But then there are these moments where it was like he would snap. It was like he's suddenly going along relatively peaceful, avoiding things, and then he's overthrowing the Iranian government. And, you know, things are okay, and then he's overthrowing the Guatemala government. And then, you know, things are okay, and he's threatening to nuke Iraq.
It's like he learned a lot from being a general.
Exactly.
And he used that, but then all of a sudden he sort of went back into the general mode.
Exactly. And then, and, you know, next thing you know, we're invading Lebanon.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah. And during the break, we were actually talking about something that I think is kind of interesting, which is what possibly could have been the motivation for the Syrian government to use gas. And then the Russians have asked for an investigation, a UN investigation in the Security Council, and it's actually the U.S. that's blocking the investigation. And so what's going on there?
Well, you know, one of the questions, of course, as you pointed out before, we don't even really know that it was the Syrian government that used the gas. There's a lot of gas out there to be used, and it's not all in the government's hands. And so then there's been no, like you said, no real investigation into it, or there maybe Russia's going for it. But the other thing that's interesting is Donald Trump, you know, I mean, he sees this and suddenly he has this moment, you know, this, oh, those poor kids moment, you know, and yet it was nothing compared to what's happened
up until then.
I mean, the death, the slaughter, the, you know, and so why all of a sudden does he suddenly get this conscience?
I mean, half a million people are dead. So you have 500,000 dead and 87 die in a really horrific way. And all of a sudden we're involved.
Yeah. And there's this line, which is the sarin gas.
Right. Even though conventional weapons are clearly more deadly. Yeah. I mean, we call chemical weapons weapon of mass destruction. That's really wrong. They're a terror weapon. It's a scary death, and it scares people. A weapon of mass destruction would be like if we released smallpox back into the population or dropped a nuke on somebody. Or did concentrated use of conventional weapons like we did on Dresden in World War II. So I think we should also be careful with our terminology that we don't do in our society. We're very loose with the way we use our words and how we talk about things. In any case, there's also 13 million displaced Syrians. Half the Syrian population is now homeless, whether they're internally homeless or they've fled and they're living in Jordan or Turkey or Lebanon.
So we should think that if he had suddenly gotten this conscience, that he would say, well, let's bring more refugees over to this country.
Absolutely. You know, yeah, I mean, if this is really a humanitarian thing,
let's do something real about this to help
people. Bring some of those children over who are suffering so much.
But no.
There's one town in Sweden of 60,000 people that has more refugees in it than the United States and Great Britain combined. More Iraqi and Syrian refugees than the United States and Great Britain combined.
I love, there's another, I occasionally I go to these, I find these things online and I print them all out and then I ignore them mostly when I get on the air. But Robert Reich, who I love, wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. He said, he was talking about what's the Trump doctrine of foreign policy. He says, at first glance, foreign policy under President Trump seems inconsistent, arbitrary, and devoid of principle. But he thinks no. He thinks there actually is a coherent strategy. And he says, of course there is a Trump doctrine. You have to know where to look for it. And so he says, the first principle of the Trump doctrine, people living in a predominantly Muslim country have a chance of entering the United States only if their country contains an edifice with Trump's name on it. You know, he says the second principle follows logically from the first. Countries that are potential markets for Trump's business, nominally run by his two sons but still filling his pockets, may be eligible for special favors if they allow Trump to make money there. And then his other two have to do with going after the bad guys.
Right.
You know, so, we can't discount, you know, because we don't know. We haven't seen Trump's taxes. We don't know where he has it. Well, we do know. We know he has investments all over the world.
Right.
You know, and the conflict of interest issue and foreign policy was also talking about the transparency issue. So, which kind of brings us in maybe a little bit to the overview of what is it? We don't know for sure. Is this day 91 or 92?
Yeah, day 91 or 92.
Day 91 and a half of the Trump presidency. What does it look like?
Well, that's...
Give me an overview. Help me to understand this, please.
Okay, so one of the things that I look at is in the first 100 days, conventionalism? No, that's an insult. the thinking is, in political science, that you get a honeymoon. So that even if you're going to have policies that people generally aren't happy with in the other party, you'll still get votes for it. For example, in 2001, Junior got his tax cuts through, and he got the tax cuts through with some Democratic votes. You will get some support in the first 100 days. And here we have a president who has both houses of Congress, and he has not gotten a single piece of primary policy passed through either house, and there isn't time left to get anything through in the next few days.
Oh, and so now all of a sudden, it's not the first 100 days that are important. It just, that just changed yesterday, I think.
Did somebody announce that?
Trump. He says that's impractical to expect all of this to happen in the first 100 days. And he's the one who's been saying, we got to get the health care, too, before that. Because it's my legacy, you know, whatever.
Right.
Destroying Obama's legacy will be my legacy. So.
Through executive order, I guess.
Right. Oh, within his executive orders, of course, are, you know, he has done incredible damage.
Right.
You know, we can't discount that.
If
doing damage is an accomplishment for, you know, for the first 100 days, he's done a lot of that, especially environmental and regulatory.
Right. One of the things you look at is how many pieces of legislation went through.
I know that's the critical.
Right, factor, so. Yeah. And LBJ and FDR are the champs in this. And it sort of shows that both people went into the White House with a very solid plan. They knew how to do politics. They understood how the system worked. They were prepared. The person with the least number of legislation through, although now he's going to be tied, was Jimmy Carter. And, you know, when we think of Jimmy Carter, we think he's a wonderful guy, good, huggable person. You can't wait for him to go out there with a hammer and build another home for a poor person, but not maybe the best president we've ever had.
Not the best president. I think I saw something that said he may have had the highest IQ.
Yeah, I believe that. I'm there. You know. But in terms of, like, his political acumen, the guy clearly wasn't a good politician. No. And, you know, he had the same situation Trump did. He had both houses of Congress, and he got zero bills through in that first 100 days. And it shows a level of, frankly, incompetence. Maybe if he had had a hostile Congress, you could say, well, he had a hostile Congress, but he's got both houses.
Well, he's turned his own party into a hostile
right.
Congress.
And he threatens them, and he talks big, and he says things that are not sustainable, and he can't back them up, and he's getting in trouble. And
if he's done anything, he's unified the Democrats, though. That's an accomplishment.
That's very true. And that is a very big accomplishment, because as a general, they're hard to get to do anything.
Yeah, the Republicans are just at each other's throats.
Yeah. And then also he has the lowest, since we've been keeping track of this, since the 40s, he has the lowest approval rating of any president in that first 100 days. He was down to 40.4, I think, at the lowest, or somewhere in that area.
I thought he went into the 30s.
It could be. But now he's gotten a little bit of a bump. When I last looked, which was yesterday, it might have been Wednesday, he was at 41.5.
Yeah, that's big. But, you know, I mean, but when he gets even these little bumps, he changes. He's always been a bully. But now he's trying to become an international bully, I guess. I don't know. But whenever he does something like drop bombs or kill innocents, whatever, he gets a bump in the polls. And I don't know what that says about us and our culture, but I also don't know how long that can last.
Well, I'm surprised at how little of a bump.
A little bump.
Well, I thought it was going to be bigger. Yeah. I find, you know, 1.5% to be shockingly low.
To be not a lot.
But then it does say something about us, because you were saying earlier, you were talking about how even
liberals... It took us away from a lot of other conversations, for one thing.
It did, for sure.
Go ahead.
But you were even saying that, like, a lot of liberal journalists seem to be all of a sudden saying he's presidential and look at our beautiful weapons. I think that...
Can I touch?
Yeah. I think that we have a strain in our society where we do like the idea that we're an empire. We're the most powerful empire on earth. You know, one of our number one industries is the weapons industry. We are the largest exporter of methods of killing people on earth. You know, we're really proud of the fact that we have a Second Amendment and we're heavily armed. I believe per capita we have the fifth highest murder rate in the world. You know, so there
we have
is
one of the worst educational systems in the healthcare systems both.
Right, but we have a lot of firearms, so it's okay.
So we can keep the bad guys from getting into the schools, I guess. I don't know.
That would probably have gotten a job if they had a decent education.
Right. That's right.
I mean, we respond with this sort of adrenaline, testosterone, macho, misogynistic way where we're you know, like, oh, look at our weapons, and oh, thank God we elected a man, and we can feel good about that and as we smash a third world country up.
Yeah, a real man, only with small hands.
They're moderately large.
Are they moderately large?
I'm pretty sure that's what he said.
Is that his term?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not that we should be using that as a gauge. But It's kind of fun.
Are they large enough to fire the missiles?
Yeah, that's the question. Can he pull a trigger? It's. I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's so mind-boggling, the whole thing, and for us to get a handle on it is so difficult. And like we say, you know, there's this grand tradition. I mean, there are those who would say that actually Trump is Trump. There are those who say Trump's foreign policy is pretty similar to that of Barack Obama, but that he's just more heavy-handed. Barack Obama had more finesse. I don't think that's exactly accurate, but...
I mean, it remains to be seen, because we'll see, you know, does he keep building up in Syria? Interestingly enough, the plan that he used to attack the airbase in Syria was Barack Obama's plan from 2013.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's actually using Barack Obama's policies.
Right.
Maybe with the exception of killing Osama bin Laden, I don't know of an event where the Obama administration actively did theater. Whereas the Moab in Afghanistan, the battle group to North Korea, the SEALs in Yemen, the missile strike in Syria, those are all clearly theater. They have no strategic value whatsoever.
I had Glenn Smith, I don't know if you, Glenn Smith, the wonderful political analyst and consultant who's on our show frequently, we were there, he was on the day after the Syrian bombing, and we were talking about different things. He says, let me tell you what it is. He says, it's theater.
It is. It really
you
is.
Know, and this was, you know, it took a little while for a lot of people to actually come to that conclusion, but he had it immediately. And I guess maybe if you were smart, you wouldn't have to. It wouldn't take you very long to come. I'm talking with Roy Casagrande, and I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Tracy Schultz, take it away.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. And as you saw me go, I was song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Okay. Tracy, Roy, what were we listening to?
Good stuff. That was recommended by our guest, a little Vera Lynn, a classic from World War II.
Right.
Nicely picked.
Yes.
She just recently had a 100-year birthday, and it's well celebrated over in Europe right now.
And she released an album.
Yeah. Still singing at 100. That's pretty good. Okay.
So you get all kinds of information on Rag Radio. See, that's what's very cool about it. My guest is Roy Casagrande. He is Associate Professor of Government at Austin Community College, where he teaches U.S. and Texas politics. His areas of research include Middle East history and politics, U.S. foreign policy, political philosophy, and warfare. And we've sort of been touching, we've been using all of those sort of those skills of yours, or those resources of yours, I guess, here in this discussion. We've been talking about Donald Trump. We've been talking about the first 91 and a half days, or whatever it is. We're not sure. And we've talked a lot about the Middle East. What about Korea? So give me a sense.
So one of the things that I keep hearing is we have to do something about Korea. Like, we have to do something. I also heard that during the campaign. You know, we have to do something. That's why I'm voting for Trump. We have to do something.
Is this kind of like when they have a bomb that the bomb squad has to come out and defuse, you know, and you don't really want to touch it? You want to be careful how you deal with it. I mean, it's like a bomb that the more you get involved with it, I don't know.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
I mean, the analogy I used was a little different. Maybe yours is better, actually. But the one I used was, you have a vase. You're worried the vase is, it's an antique, it's a Ming vase. You're worried it's going to fall and break over, so you take a baseball bat and smash it to pieces.
There you go.
Now you don't have to worry about
okay.
it. You're right. You're worried a war is going to start, so what are you going to do to stop the war from starting?
Start it.
The war. I don't understand. When I look at this, you know, North Korea rattles its saber periodically. The Obama administration was really expert at ignoring it. The situation we're in is we are in large part because of Junior's policy in 2001 of not complying with a treaty that we made with the North Koreans in 93. So what happened was, in 1992, North Korea decided it was going to pursue the nuke. George Bush Sr. decided he was going to wait until the election before he did anything. Lo and behold, he doesn't get reelected. It's Clinton. Clinton comes in. He talks big, saber rattling, lots of threats. And the North Koreans take notice. They get scared. Like, Clinton says, I'm not going to let you get the nuke. We'll bomb you. You will not get the nuke. And we end up at the negotiating tables with the North Koreans. The Chinese, the Russians, the Japanese, and the South Koreans are also there. And the six of us come up with a pretty decent treaty. As far as treaties go, I think it's actually a genius treaty. The five states will provide North Korea with food and coal. And that will continue until 2001, at which point the United States will begin building heavy water reactors to replace the reactor that the North Koreans were building. You can't use heavy water reactors to make nukes. And that way they would have nuclear power to run their electricity. It would be cheap, clean, efficient, but then they wouldn't get the nuke in the process. And then in the meantime, they would turn over the stuff that they were working on to the UN. It wouldn't have to be destroyed until we started the heavy water reactors. Clinton leaves the White House, Junior becomes president, and he decides we're not building those heavy water reactors. And so I think it was a year later, they detonate the nuke. Like, it took North Korea almost no time to respond to us unilaterally abrogating the treaty. And now what do we do? There was a way to not let them get the nuke. And in fact, Junior realized this, and in 2008 backtracks and goes running to the North Koreans and goes, look, we'll do the treaty that you came up with. And the North Koreans seemed to be interested at first, and then they just walked away.
Right.
And then Obama's whole policy was, try not to feed into the drama. Try not to do, you know, they're freaking out. They're doing something antagonistic. We'll just ignore them and hope that kind of sorts itself out. And then, of course, we ended up with Kim Jong-un, who's vicious, right? He's killed a half-brother. He's killed an uncle. You know, he purges. He's not scared to send people to gulags.
And he may have it be as irrational as Donald Trump.
And maybe as narcissistic. And so, we have two narcissists, and both of them are doing their best to sort of push their domestic policy agendas by using foreign policy as a means of distracting the public and making them look tough. And then that's the perfect breeding ground for a mistake.
Yeah. You know, maybe what we've needed all along was a really good psychotherapist who knew how to deal with paranoids. But then that's another story.
Right.
So where do we, I mean, considering that there seems to be a rampant kind of endemic paranoia in North Korea, I mean, it seems like that or not?
I mean, that, no, I from what I can tell, the Kim Jong-un regime is an irrational regime. It is, unpredictable. So right. So we don't know what they're going to do. We don't know how they're going to react.
Right.
It would be terrible for their life expectancy if they actually deployed the nuke preemptively. But, you know, that's the problem with people who don't seem to be using all of their faculties, that they do make bad decisions and bad choices. North Korea doesn't need a missile to successfully drop nukes on South Korea. And and even though its missiles aren't very accurate, it could probably get most of the targets it would want in Japan. And forget the humanitarian disaster that would be, and forget the fact that Japan and Korea are allies. We're talking about the third largest economy, and I believe Korea is the 11th or the 12th largest economy on Earth. It would be globally destructive to the world economy. Why play that game? Why not play a different game? Why not try to, sit down and talk? Why not talk about what we could do to alleviate North Korea's economic problems? South Korea has been wanting to re-engage with North Korea, and in fact, it looks like in the next presidential election, South Korea is going to get a guy who wants to actually cool relations with the United States and start talking to the Chinese more and the North Koreans more. And, you know, that might be the path that needs to be taken in order to get the situation on the peninsula calmed down.
Yeah. Are there any other aspects of that, or shall we jump back to the 90 days angle?
Well, I mean, I think there is something interesting about it that goes back to Syria, is both Syria and Korea look like unsolvable problems. And so it's really fascinating to me that that the Trump administration would try to cripple Obamacare by defunding it. So he's not solving a problem. He's getting rid of the only solution we've ever attempted to use to deploy. And then he's meddling in Korea and Syria in ways that those are, again, also probably not solvable. In fact, neither is Afghanistan. I mean, I will tell you,
these are all places that it seems like when you meddle with them, you do more damage than solving them.
Right. And I mean, Afghanistan is so nuanced that the reason we can't win isn't necessarily because we can't win militarily. It's not even that we can't win because the Afghan population doesn't want to win. It's because when we train their police and their army, every year, the trained personnel, one quarter to one third of it goes AWOL and defects. And some of it joins the Taliban, some of it joins warlords, some of it just goes off into the hills. They're armed trained people that no longer serve the Afghan state and are off doing their own thing. One quarter to one third every year. We've been doing this for 15 years. Like we've built the Afghan army multiple times now. You can't win that war. I mean, that's not a winnable scenario.
It's, you know, we thought when we lost, when the United States lost to in Vietnam, it had come across a form of warfare and a kind of that it was not capable of dealing with, was not capable of winning. It was impossible to win. And now look at what we're facing. I mean, Vietnam pales in comparison. Guerrilla, that kind of dealing with guerrilla warfare is so expanded and so,
Right, the Vietnamese weren't attacking Europe and the United States.
Well,
now we've
We created this, or we interpreted what was happening as this domino effect that we thought threatened the quote civilized world. I guess I don't know.
Right, but the complexity of the situation is that this is a type of warfare where you don't know. It's not just that you don't know who the enemy is. The enemy might be with you.
But that was true even then, in Vietnam too.
In the aftermath of Vietnam, the American public seemed to be really reluctant to do another war, and the Reagan administration referred to it as the Vietnam syndrome. And Reagan made it his expressed goal to get the American public warmed up to the idea of warfare again, which is why we got involved in Lebanon, and of course that turned disastrous. So then that's why we invaded Grenada. And it worked. I mean, next thing you know, we're doing Panama, and then we're doing Iraq. And so the irony, I think, of you bringing in the Vietnam situation is that we had learned a lesson, and then we ended up with two presidents, Reagan and Bush, who spent their entire 12 years trying to get us to unlearn that lesson. And now we're back to, it seems that we're going to have to learn the lesson again.
You brought up the healthcare issue and the Affordable Care, Obamacare, whatever we want to call it, and it has been established now. I mean, it's the law of the land, And all of the attempts to overturn it just seem to have been totally futile. And the popularity now all of a sudden of Obamacare is like in the 60s.
Right.
And so they're not going to get rid of it. They can't. I mean, look what happened. Those town hall meetings. I mean, there was a genuine, legitimate uprising. They weren't all paid. Not all of them, anyway.
I want to know how I can get onto this payroll.
Yeah, we were looking for that payroll because I've been in so many demonstrations. Yeah. Nobody's
do I get
been
back
passing
pay?
Out the checks. So, yeah, at some point you can just send them a bill, I guess. But, so what can happen is that Trump can sabotage it.
Right. He can defund it.
He can defund it, essentially.
And he can also do executive orders to sabotage it.
Yes. But I don't think that's... I think there's enough people around him who have some sense, maybe.
Well, I mean, that's also a weird thing about the Trump administration. There are clearly these factions. There's, the alt-right, which is a euphemism for neo-Nazi. And that's the Steve Bannon faction. But then there's the liberal Democrat faction, which is led by Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. And then, there's the Reince Priebus faction, which is sort of the establishment Republican, just cut our taxes faction. And there's all these little factions, but the two big ones, of course, are the Bannon and Kushner factions. And they're not polar opposites by any means. I mean, a liberal obviously isn't a polar opposite of a Nazi, but they're certainly very different, right? And the fact that you've got these factions and the fact that Trump's rhetoric is toned down over the last few weeks, and then also Bannon lost his National Security Council seat, suggests that...
There's even been talk that he's actually being pushed out.
Right, which suggests that Jared Kushner is actually winning.
Although I doubt that he's going to be very far away, even if he gets, quote, pushed out.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, Manafort never completely disappeared.
No,
yeah.
No.
Also
the sentiment, the white nationalists.
Yeah, Trump has been so careful not to alienate the white nationalist population. Like, when all those attacks were happening on the Jewish community centers, and people kept trying to get Trump to say something about it, and he was so careful not to say anything, and finally he did, but it was like pulling teeth.
Okay, so what's going to happen? Give me your prophecy, your sense of how this is all going to move forward.
I just have no idea. So
I was afraid that was going to be your answer.
And in part because I think Trump, Robert Reich is saying that there is actually a Trump foreign policy, but I don't think there is. I don't see one. There's a little tongue in cheek there.
A little facetious there.
But I mean, he's looking for the patterns, which are, that there's the business interests. And Trump has business interests in Baku, Azerbaijan, in a hotel where one of the people who's actually invested in it is the Revolutionary Guard from Iran. So the people that he's supposedly enemies with, on the one hand, are his business partners in Baku. And, having a president that has that kind of weird... I don't know. I don't know what any of this means. I don't know how this turns out.
An aspect of it has to be a kind of amorality, I guess.
An amorality and an inconsistency and an unpredictability, which makes it so that you don't know how this is going to go next. I think maybe the real interesting thing about Trump is the impact he's going to have on European elections. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands has already lost his race as the white nationalist, and probably as a result of people seeing how Trump behaves and going, we don't want that here in the Netherlands. And it makes me wonder about Marine Le Pen in France.
Yeah, their one hope right now is that they just had this terrorist incident and they're playing that to the hilt.
Right.
But the communist or the far left candidate, I can't think of
Mélenchon.
Right, yeah, has been climbing.
He has been climbing. Yeah. And then Macron is, been pretty steady. But, he's an outsider that nobody really knows much about other than that he used to be a socialist.
Yeah.
Then there's going to be the election in Britain, and then the election in Germany.
But all those French candidates are all mixed bags.
They're all mixed bags.
even the leftists have, nationalists.
That's true. There's talk of Frexit amongst the...
And Le Pen has some leftist stuff. So, France is weird.
It's very weird.
France is weird.
Yeah, and I think Trump... If Trump... if I get my way, Trump will get out of North Korea and leave it alone. Just let the North, let the South Koreans, the Japanese, and the Chinese figure that out.
Do you have much influence?
I've been asking myself that, and I don't think I do.
You don't think they're listening?
But I have a feeling that in the case of Syria, he's going to just focus on ISIL and leave the government alone.
Okay, we've been having so much fun that we're almost out of time. Give me like, huh? You, tell us about that. Yes.
Okay, yeah, so there's a movie. It's called Tear Down the Walls, Open Bethlehem by Leila Sansour. It'll be happening tomorrow at 4 o'clock at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church.
Cool. Oh,
very cool.
All right. Well, we'll tell people. And I also want to mention that, what? Was there anything else?
Jim, should I mention that it's Jim Rubenstein's church? What?
Filmmaker.
The filmmaker will be present.
Oh, and that's cool. And it is at Jim Rigby's church. And Jim Rigby is a, I think at this point, a heroic figure.
I agree.
In Austin. Yeah. So, I do want to tell, speaking of events, that many of you who listen to the show know about the book that we produced, which the Celebrating the Rag, Austin's Iconic Underground Newspaper, which is really kind of catching fire in a sense. I mean, I don't, it's getting lots of mileage, and there's going to be a big event at Houston's Brazos Bookstore on May 18th, and the editors Thorne Dreyer, Alice Embry, and Richard Croxdale will be there. And so you all be there if you're in Houston, especially. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.